everybody. Welcome to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Why Revisited. I'm Willie Romano Pugh.
Hey there. My name's Jakob, and this is a podcast where we take a really in-depth look at the show The Wire and offer you our deep reads.
And as always, you know, we've had some helpful people, you know, give us some love. If you want to give us some love, anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. Give us 5 stars on any podcast platform you're listening to this on. Give us a nice review. You know, it'll help us out a great deal. And with that, you know, Jakob, I hope you're doing good. Let's talk about The Wire Season 3, Episode 5, Straight and True.
Yep, that's how we're shooting it today. Straight and True. Okay. Yeah, thanks for all those shout outs, and let's just get right into it. So Bubs is out on the town, and he's lamenting life as a junkie, as far as someone who's aging, which we know the creators of the show spent a lot of time. Obviously the coroner, Simon, of course, always talks about how the older the junkies get, the harder it is to really sustain that lifestyle. And Bubbles he's not like Johnny anymore. And, you know, tired of the capers and this and that, even though they're about to get into some schemes. So what's your thoughts on all of Bubbles' takes and yeah. So forth?
I mean, I know we were kind of joking around just a little bit back there about, like, you know, oh, it's Straight and True, but there's kind of like a recurring theme throughout this episode, I'd say, of various characters trying to go like on the straight and narrow path, or whatever you want to call it. And it's kind of ironic that Bubs is kind of rebuking the lifestyle that Johnny is putting forth, since Bubs was kind of like his mentor in a way and taught him like everything he knew about the junkie lifestyle. But Johnny has like the old ways still kind of ingrained in his brain, and he's looking at Bubs like he's a snitch now, working for the cops to, you know, get $30 a day and whatnot. I mean, he's still addicted to heroin, so he's still got a really rough time ahead of him, but at least he's trying to, like, you know, at least put in some useful work instead of pulling off these capers with a shaky ladder with a paint atop the, you know, standing on top of it, doing a paint job and pulling off like a little scheme like that. So yeah, it's a interesting little, you know, that's why great TV shows are really something to behold, because we get to see characters evolve over time and their positions change. And they're not just like these archetypes or, you know, these stereotypes that we just kind of like associate with, like, oh, you know, Bubbles, he's a junkie. But like, we see, you know, things, we see the wheel turning of, you know, him maybe like hopefully one day getting sober. Like, we see some growth on his part that you don't get with, you know, lesser TV shows or even like a 2-hour movie. So this opening is a great example of how TV is really a writer's medium in a lot of way. Thank you.
I know Bubbles is he's got a bank account. Can Johnny get off his back? But I want to ask you about, you know, what your thoughts are on their, I guess, yeah, this is a caper, like you said. I mean, I guess, you know, capers can get creative. We normally think of them stealing or, you know, like metal and stuff like that. But I guess these schemes, you know, these like skits they pull off are part of that. But, you know, Johnny's very eager, obviously. But Bubbles, even though he's not really into it, still the wise sage, like, well, stupid, if we're going to be pulling this off, I mean, you're the white dude here. So look at that guy who's painting. The whole conversation on race, is there like, am I looking too far ahead or spending too much time trying to dissect this with, you know, like the whole themes surrounding that involving politics or revolving around the mayoral candidacy?
I mean, they kind of like lay out the whole like conversation about race just in that brief little exchange they have, where Bubbles is like, oh, you're gonna have to be the good guy in this scenario, which is like really horrible, sad thing to say. But yeah, that guy who's just like out there painting alone, like, that's pretty shitty, like contracting job he's stuck with. Like, he don't, like, have anybody to, like, back him up or anything. Like, it seems like unfair that he has to be put in a dangerous position like that. Like, he's on top of, like, a rickety ass ladder. Like, he's lucky that it's just Johnny and Bubbles. Like, it could be
OSHA. No, he could use a cutty. I mean, he knows the neighborhood. He's a hard worker.
I love this little caper they're doing. Like, this is something almost like, you know, we see them, as you said, like, doing the scrap metal capers and stuff like that. But this is almost kind of like similar to what McNulty and Bunk are pulling off at the bar, where they have like a little like acting routine laid out.
Oh yeah. Johnny's also taking a dive in front of a, like, done the fake car accident thing. Oh, yeah. with the colostomy bag or soup colostomy bag.
Right.
So they got their, you know, acting 101 or whatever. But at the end of it all, Johnny gets paid, and yeah, Bubbles isn't into it. You know, he's got his little gig. It's lined up, even though you don't think he's getting paid enough. I mean, you selfishly weren't even thinking about Jimmy's current financial situation, being behind on alimony by $2,000. Okay, it could be a departmental stipend. We know how messy that can get. I'm not trying to be a Jimmy apologist, because he, you know, he's I mean, that's a whole different story. But yeah, they are. I mean, like we see with him and Kima, right? I mean, he has to basically, he knows where Marlo parks is, what we assume, personal ride with his Mercedes. I'm way too tall to not know anything about SUVs. Like, people, I guess I just want to get made fun of my entire life for driving small sedans and pushing the seat all the way back to where it just looks uncomfortable. But hey, it works. Anyway, sorry.
But anyway, yeah. So the last time we see Bubbles in this episode, he's talking with Kima. He's working on a business plan of his own, separate from Johnny, trying to go slightly more legitimate and separate himself from thankless tasks that only have a little bit to show for it each day. Spending money for, you know, the day supply of heroin.
Brutal. And hey, it's great timing too, because we see that Johnny's gonna get recruited to fill in, do his thing as a junkie in, you know, Amsterdam, which is essentially the beginning of the end for him.
When he's dropped off in that zone, we kind of see like the spark in his eye or whatever, realizing like, oh man, this is heaven for me. Like, I'm home. Like, I can just, this is basically like my playground.
Which, yeah,
you know, arguments can be made whether or not it was like an ethical decision on Bunny's part to, you know, undergo this whole operation. And certainly it does do a lot of good for, you know, they have like needle exchange programs there eventually. And, you know, they're able to focus on more substantive police work, but maybe they don't do enough outreach to get to people like Johnny, who are a lot farther off from finding sobriety than Bubbles is.
Yeah, so another character who's trying to change his ways, or maybe displaying, what's that old adage, progress isn't a straight line. It's Cuddy. He's getting woken up by Mima, because he's got appointments he's made, and has to get some encouragement to get up and at him. He's been partying. It's wild.
Yeah, he's hungover from like getting shotgunned that blunt by Slum Charles and having an orgy. So his grandma, I think, is kind of like catching on a little bit that maybe he's not a bouncer at a bar. And
yeah, he's at a bar, he's at the party, but not necessarily working, right, working the door. Half truth. It is The Wire, right? It's a little gray area.
See Cuddy doing some surveillance with Gerard and Sapper, pretty thick-headed guys who were tasked with intimidating or like finding out that about this one of these Barksdale soldiers who's possibly stealing from the stash and giving it to his girlfriend. And we see that Cuddy, you know, even though he's been out of the loop for 14 years, he has some good strategies up his sleeve to get to the bottom of it that is way more intuitive than any ideas that they're putting forth. But at the same time, we can see like inklings of like what led him to, you know, take on such a huge sentence, because he does the cocaine with them. He's indulging in the party lifestyle. He's like, oh, you know, I got a piss test, and they're like, oh, we got clean piss for you, and that's like all that he needs.
But in between all that, I know you're like going straight to the blow, but I mean, doesn't he meet with the deacon too before he does the ayo for yayo? And he's like, you know, all the layers that they stack in here, especially given the episode and the meeting between String and Marlo and their conversation. Having little Melvin as the deacon in this, you know, especially this episode, it's like, this is crazy. What can I say? But Cuddy's not into it, into what the deacon has to say as far as going through that process and putting in the time necessary. I mean, also coupled with the fact that he's, you know, a hardened criminal.
We see flashes of his brutal side. Well, we do see him, you know, he buys some clean urine to take to the parole officer so he could, you know, continue to evade getting, you know, having a watchful eye over him by the authorities and whatnot.
Cuddy slaps a high school girl.
Yeah, man, that's crazy. Like, that's, so he has like a good hunch that he brings to Gerard and Sapper, like, oh, if this dealer that's stealing from Avon has a girlfriend, that's probably where all of his money is going to go. And then they approach her in the street and he slaps like her really hard. And it's like, you know, when I think of Cuddy's character, I think of like this really, you know, this really inspiring story about this guy who is able to like turn his life around and, you know, provide a positive outlet for a lot of young kids. And I like forgot about this scene where he really shows like his viciousness, and it's quite a coup, like on in terms of like the writing, that they were able to infuse his character with like enough sympathy that, you know, they could pull off his redemption arc in a believable way, like that, like even though he, you know, beats the shit out, well, he does, you know, he slaps this girl really hard, but in the end, like, he's one of the most sympathetic characters. Like, I feel like that's something we can't really see in a lot of like TV and movies these days, where it's you know, everybody's so fucking sensitive. No, I'm just kidding.
Immediately canceled. Yeah. A minor too.
Yeah, I mean, it's fucking, it's like horrible, like what he does, and it shouldn't be you know, minimized or rationalized in any way. But yeah, it just goes to show you that they do a lot of work with this story to get him on that redemption hype. And they do a really great job, because they show like how, like the potential for like how, you know, crazily he can bottom out, and it brings questions to mind, like, did he do this with grace? Like, maybe that's why. I mean, you know, he was in jail for 14 years, so things are going to happen while he's gone, but that could be, you know, part of the reason why she is like so adamant in maintaining some distance from him.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it can be coupled with his actions towards this young lady, but as, you know, the situation escalates with the dealer, that they're tasked with getting repoing his jewels or his jewelry that he's been buying with all the money he's stealing from the Barksdales. Cuddy's kind of like, you know, he's obviously seen a lot, and he's killed someone and maybe more, who knows, but he doesn't partake in the violence to the degree that, sorry, what are their names again, the two
I believe it's Gerard and Sapper.
Zapper?
Sapper? Like sap?
Sapper.
Tree sap?
Got it. So, yeah, I mean, he's still kind of displaying his old school mentality, where he knows that the guy needs to still work for them to make his money back and be profitable to the organization, but they kill him anyway. So obviously they're kind of barreling towards the end of the reunion, where Avon has to come and get things in line because Stringer's so out of touch with the, you know, everything that's happening on the street as far as, you know, regulating and whatnot. But I just noticed there was a tag on the wall in the background of this brutal beating and murder. Said Willie, even though it's spelled IE, it just, you know, maybe a sign of some much needed violence as you added to.
Which is interesting because this isn't even a Pelicanos episode. but it's some really great acting on Chad Coleman's part in this whole set piece, because he's, of course, like used to seeing people get killed. You know, it's what ended up him. It's what, you know, ultimately made him end up in jail in the first place. But at the same time, he has like a more of an eye towards pragmatism. And I think he conveys like really effectively that it's probably not the right call to just like beat this guy to death in the middle of the street. And it's going to cause like quite of a headache. So he's not like traumatized or like distraught or anything, but he just is like, he maybe like feels like a tinge of regret at like letting this happen. And then again, it's like pretty crazy that he ends up being like one of the most sympathetic, inspiring characters throughout the whole show, when we see that he's involved in something like so brutal like this, even though he doesn't put hands on the guy at all. But just like the little looks he gives after they like finally end up like beating him in the head with the baseball bat to death, he gives kind of a look around like, is anybody watching us? Like, I'm probably in violation of my parole by doing this. Just a range of
probably.
Yeah, just a good range of emotion. So I want to give a good thumbs up to that performance there.
Oh yeah. And you know me, I may not know all my, you know, film or literary terms, but I am nitpicky. I think they are in a like an alleyway, right? Or like a little abandoned area. I mean, it's not like in the street. I mean, even if people did see, are those some guys you really want to go out of your way to tell on, especially the way we know witnesses are treated? And we're going to talk about some of that stuff. But Jimmy's out and about. You know, I've been up to my remixes lately. Why you always spying? Jimmy, why you always spying? Oh,
sorry. There you go. Is that going to be a copyright violation? Are we going to get sued for that?
Yeah. Won't include fair use or snippets of audio that could fall under fair use, but we'll always risk the lawsuits for a little jingle parodies and whatnot. Yeah, you know, you never know. Maybe we could do some research and cut a little remix album, Wire remixes. Maybe I'll be the Weird Al the Wire. That's where this is headed.
Nice. So we got Jimmy going into Stringer's copy shop, not looking to have any copies made, but just trying to touch base with his old pal there.
Gets offered a pretty nice, maybe he could have got a deal in the condo down by the Hippodrome, or I mean, we see what it looks like later on, if that's anything in the ballpark of you know, as far as Avon's new digs. So maybe Jimmy missed an opportunity here. I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is like the last, I feel like this is, if, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the last time that Jimmy and Stringer like ever really interact with each other. Like, it's funny that they have such an adversarial relationship, but they barely like ever talk with each other. And when they do, it's like all coded in these like euphemisms where they're basically just like saying fuck you to each other. The most like, you know, blatant example of when they were talking about how they really feel about each other was through Stringer's little doodle that he was doing in the courtroom in the first episode. This is a really fantastically written scene, because Jimmy is like talking about how, you know, he had really high hopes for them to continue on their little cat and mouse escapades, and that, you know, he was kind of his alter ego or whatnot, and he was gonna, you know, he found his true match with him. But Stringer is really cautious of being surveilled and is trying to, in a sense, leave a lot of this bullshit behind and run a legitimate business. So he's just, you know, putting it all out there that, like, you know, here's my business card, call me if you need anything, and I'll get you a deal on a condo, which must really, I mean, talking about Jimmy's financial situation again, how much of a burn is that to him? That like Stringer is now in a much more financial advantageous position than him, and he's kind of like rubbing it in his face that he's developing condos and stuff like that.
Jimmy can't catch a break here. Well, he can't get out of his own way, but he had high hopes for them, so I don't know exactly. Yeah, that's probably like cop speak or something, right? Like high hopes was, I don't know, seeing the moping bracelets. Hey String, you ever go down to the oh no really, you got a condo for me? Is it down by the ocean?
Bunk is still tasked with the needle in a haystack like job of finding Dozerman's gun. You know, we talked a little bit about this the last episode, where that's not really about like anything substantive. It's just like the police having a hard on for, you know, good press and not wanting to seem incompetent in that sense, even though there's evidence of incompetence on like many other levels within the department. But he's kind of straying from that a little bit in this one scene where he's starting to find out that the victim in the shootout was maybe not an innocent bystander. And he's talking to a random guy when Landsman pulls up and reminds him of what's what and tells him to get back to his job of finding Dozerman's gun when he's actually trying to do real police work.
How random is this guy? I mean, this wino grew up and, you know, he saw Omar come of age in that area. Basically, he needs to go up to North and Pulaski, as Landsman, as you said, Landsman tells him to do, yeah. Which is, well, I guess he'd be going down. He's in Pimlico. I don't know. Yeah, it's just Bunk's at a, you know, he's getting to, well, maybe all the aggravation, you know, kind of builds into that pretty, really good scene with Omar. So, right. But we'll get there, you know.
We also see this kind of montage of him like interviewing people in the like in a bunch of different convicts trying to get a lead on where he could find the gun. And it's very similar to in season two when Bunk and Lester are like interviewing a lot of the different
shipmen.
So when they're interviewing the sailors, it's just like a montage of them like getting useless information or no information at all, where like at one point it's really funny when he gets a lead on like somebody that's maybe named Ink, who might have some clues as to the location of the gun. And this guy is like, well, am I talking about Inky Dink or Fat Ink or Stink Ink? You know, it's all kinds of little nicknames there that's just like brought up in rapid succession that makes me laugh.
He didn't say it was Ink. I thought he said Dink. Wasn't there someone named Dink?
Yeah.
Dink. Wasn't there someone?
Sorry. That's what it was. It wasn't Ink. It was Dink.
Who's named Dink? Like in previous episodes, was there something like Dink Dink? Maybe Dink is like another peanut or something, you know? But yeah. How many murders was it? 4 murders that he wants to get out from under for a gun. More frustrating situations while he could be out doing real police work.
That's right.
He could be out there being the natural police that he is. Back at the detail, they're kind of closing this chapter. Lester and Jimmy seem to be coming to a you know, sort of an agreement or realizing that this chapter involving surveillance on String, well, it's not ending, but, you know, Jimmy's committing to, you know, doing the job or joining the detail, and their new target can tell. So
there's no legitimate way for them to track where Stringer's finances go, because he's laundered it through so many legit businesses that can't really trace it back to drug money. And so move on to what Daniels was asking for in the first place before they decided to go rogue.
Yeah, just trying to realize their worst fears, which was similar to the you know, the situation that this original detail with Ed Burns and those guys back in the day realized that you know, things might be slipping away as far as Melvin and Chin Farmer and all them going so legit that they, you know, wouldn't be able to track them through drug money. So and it worked for some, like what's his name, this property development stuff's a lot like Kenny Bird or whatever, that crazy guy, the stevedore drug dealing strip club owner. Yeah. Oh man, it's all so crazy. Jimmy, well, he has to do some family stuff. He is a dad, right? I mean,
yeah, he goes to an open house with his ex-wife to you know, investigate what type of school they're thinking of taking their kids to. And he meets Terry D'Agostino there, and he seduces her by talking about like children's like math. It's kind of a bizarre cut where he's like talking to her about like the math curriculum at the school that she's an alumni of, and then the next scene they're having sex. So but you know, two attractive people just getting down to it. And then she McNulty's him in the morning by asking him to leave. Must be a bitter pill for him to swallow.
Yeah, I mean, it was the math, but it was also like he was lying about being on the board at another prestigious school, right? And then he's also a cop, you know. Yeah. She's like, oh, a city cop. Maybe he's like having some bubbles at moments, like, oh man, looking for something. Well, the study will come later on. He's like his own type of junkie in some ways, right?
But anyway, from there, we get to see more of what Bunny is doing to kind of enact his plan. We talked a little bit about it already with Johnny being dropped in the middle of Hamsterdam, but can you lead us in a little bit of like how Bunny is kind of switching up his approach to make it more of a reality there?
Yeah, well, he's noticing it's pretty hopeless at the Western precinct or the Western district headquarters, because his sergeants, like people like Carver, are pretty much content to just do more of the same, but better and straight and true, right? So he's just going to kind of, he's on his mission to tell it like it is, right? Where he's just not for the same old tricks. That's all, like the deacons told him, sweeping leaves on a windy day. And he's going to take a more targeted approach. And, you know, he has a lot of experience in the bureaucracy of the police department, chain of command, middle management. And that's who he wants to target. So he could, is this episode where he's like, I'm going to, you know, yeah, basically run a comm stat on their ass? Or
it's interesting. So we see him getting chewed out by his superiors, and then when he tries to gather up like all the hoppers and like teach them a lesson, they kind of like shit on him. But then when he's like talking to the mid-level drug dealers, he's like actually like pretty effective in getting his message across. So it just goes to show you that like middle school aged drug dealers are way more terrifying than, yeah, I'm really scared of young people just in general. But that's, you know, a whole other conversation for maybe like a professional like counselor or so, like therapist or something. I don't know.
Hey, they do say eighth grade, you know, that's the worst. Anyways, I mean, yeah, he gets he gets a hold of these guys, but no thanks to incompetent, misguided, DU like flex squads who just, you know, they don't really gather intel. They just do street rips, and you know, you realize this is a big problem. Has to go down to the detail to pretty much get a binder full of intel, which he's pretty amazed by. Obviously knows Jimmy, I want to ask you what he said that Bushy Top had more NID or IAD complaints, because isn't that internal affairs? Like, what the hell is Jimmy up to? You know, was he out there? Was he out there herking before? Before now, he's all, but it's more like,
I bet it's,
he's just sticking his nose where he's not supposed to be. And stuff.
Yeah, I bet you it's that he's probably just doing like the same shit that we see him doing throughout the run of this series, where he's making work harder for everybody. So people are fucking like complaining that he's like actually trying to get them to do work.
Not only is dealing with Carver and his squad a headache, it also their lack of ability to build any sort of rapport, or build any sort of intelligence on what's happening on the street. It almost costs them because the detail actually maybe is a little overzealous, because they feed intel to Colvin and his squads that Marlo's in like some middle management. Or, you know, how does this whole confrontation with Marlo transpire with Herc, you know, almost getting beat down? They're outnumbered. Right. That's bad intel on behalf of like Kima and Lester and Daniels and all them.
Yeah.
They don't know. They don't know.
I mean, we talked about this before, that like they're still under the impression that Marlo's working with Stringer. And when they're kind of like spying him out at one point in this episode and they see them meeting with each other, it's like evidence to them that Stringer is like, he still has like some stake in the drug game, so to speak. So they can still like tail him somehow, or have like some intel on him to potentially indict him, or, you know, wrap him up in a case or whatever.
All he knows, he's just like, he calls him the spawn of the devil himself, or he's the devil.
Yeah.
But then they're like, you know what we should do? Herc and Carr probably put themselves in there just being, you know, toxic masculinity took over. But Kima kind of knows they've messed up and has help on standby, whatever that meant.
I feel like this is also like a really important turning point for Carver's character, when we kind of like see him, the wheels turning in his head, so to speak, of him realizing that he's not, you know, fully living up to the potential that Bunny thinks he is, when he doesn't like know enough about like the names of the mid-level drug dealers and he's just doing street rips or whatever. But in that whole confrontation with Marlo, where Herc is like really instigating stuff, Carver is the one to pick up like, oh shit, we're outnumbered here and we're about to get fucking killed if we like keep taking this any further. So it's a, you know, it's a neat little detail that shows that Carver is also growing as a person over time.
And as, you know, dangerous or intimidating and lethal as Marlo, you know, seems in that moment, I just want to give him and his crew props, though, for having a very socially distanced meetup, drug shop or meeting spot, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's very, compatible, for any number of pandemics. I mean, but yeah, the man's is a visionary. Are you killing yourself over contractors like Barlow, or are you contracting killers like Marlo? We won't stop till we hit the town drunk like Bunk and run into Jamie Hector at Harlow.
Oh,
that's really great, man. I love that.
That's what but if we're drunk like Bunk, I don't know. I don't know if it will
try to burn all our clothes.
Yeah, I'll just he'll just stare. good guy, you know.
Yeah, man, that flow took on a whole new level of meaning hearing it out loud, as opposed to just reading it over the Google Hangouts chat.
What about Colvin's talk? I know we kind of are coming back to that after, you know, all good pertinent stuff we've talked about, but he kind of, you know, he's coming to the realization and the gravity situation as far as establishing Hamsterdam, getting the wheels turning. Bodhi's really pretty sharp. So, Colvin also saying some, like, he's talking about some biblical stuff, right? But was he, I mean, he was threatening Bodhi with like some rough rides or something like that. I mean, you know, it's all depicted. it's depiction, right? So
right.
And I get a little, it's just my own internal, like, oh man, going into this project, I was a little bit apprehensive. You know, is there too many times that you can watch this show? Will I risk, you know, the kind of like a little, you know, becoming a little disillusioned here with this show? But, you know, we're more than halfway there, right? And Colvin's also got some big problems because there's a member of the community that he's trying to salvage actually living in Amsterdam. So yeah. Oh, I don't know if you mentioned that, but that caused me a lot of anxiety the first time I watched this, Willie. I'm like, oh no. But yeah, that's going to evolve, but just more layers of irony and whatever you want to call it. So another storyline, of course, it is season 3. We're building towards the political aspect that's kind of gathering its legs.
We got Carchetti all worked up over a state's witness that got killed, and he's trying to is it a good faith effort to hear Royce about it and talk about it, or is this all just part of his larger strategic plan to like throw it back in his face when he's running for mayor later?
He's looking out for the well-being of the state's witnesses and, you know, the sanctity of the rule of law and these institutions that are, you know, supposed to be looking out for people. You know, he wants more done for the witnesses, aside from getting shoved into a flea bag motel out on Route 40. Also known as the Pulaski Highway, home to maybe a rather infamous motel, El Rich.
Right, we discussed that at length in the season 2 finale. A lot of great Yelp reviews of that provided us some comic material.
Yeah, I mean, so if you ever question Carchetti's humanity or his motives, just, you know, maybe he doesn't mind that people are getting sent to places like the El Rich Motel, but he thinks they deserve more than just that. Like, to your point, you know, he is a politician. I'm no political analyst, but you know, I think, I mean, even if he feels like an other in the city, or he's, you know, waking up, well, we get that he's obviously a white guy running for mayor in a majority black city. He still does care, even if he is in the more elite circles. And as you said, you know, his ideals may come across as, you know, more progressive, but we'll see in the long run. It doesn't really pan out. It seems like he's, you know, maybe that the meeting that he went to on the west side kind of, you know, even though that's not his district, it woke something up, or he feels like he's responsible. He just doesn't want to be fixing potholes and be powerless and so forth. So he's weighing his options.
Right. We might have gotten more insight into like what his true political ambitions were at this point, and like what all his maneuvering meant, if we ever had gotten that City Hall spinoff that David Simon had wanted to do at one point, but which got rejected because, as he put it, HBO didn't want two shows about Baltimore that nobody's watching.
Well, we're watching.
Yeah.
We're watching it now. Still are, right? Would have been great. So, yeah, I mean, what about the kind of insight into the relationship of you know, Anthony Gray or Tony and Tommy, right? They're really going at it, playing some squash, and then we'll see kind of their dynamic at the meeting.
I mean, it is like their attitude towards each other while they're playing that game is kind of like representative of like what their whole dynamic is going to be from this point on, because Tommy has kind of like opened up Pandora's box in a way to get a Tony in the competitive political spirit, and they're going to be at each other's throats eventually when they're both running for mayor. You know, Tony Gray takes a more adversarial position during the city council meeting with Rawls and Burrell. So yeah, we see him kind of taking a page from Carcetti's playbook, even though Carcetti wants him to back off.
Yeah, he lets him off the hook. Kind of adjourns things. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, definitely an intriguing relationship. And we'll talk more about the baseline of Baltimore politics, historical context that kind of inspired that. Some pretty interesting stuff with, you know, O'Malley and Lawrence Bell III, I think. You know, kind of like, hey, man, when your idols become rivals, okay, I don't think it applies to that situation. Oh, man, but yeah. Strings attempting to forge a new path to doing business in the city with his New Day Co-op. But what's up with the whole like hotel, you know, events? I mean, might have more insight into this, but everything looks pretty blatantly advertised on whatever you call that thing.
Anyway, so they have the New Day Co-op advertised at the hotel, but I guess, I mean, that's kind of like, it could be anything really. So they're hiding in plain sight, I guess. They're not letting anybody know that they're running a drug operation by a name as vague as that. But it is kind of like, oh, shit, they really are just like putting it all out there, like in the street for everybody to see. And some really great material in here where Prop Joe is commending everybody for handling it like Republicans and shit. And Shamrock is writing all the information down because it's something he learned from Robert's Rules of Order. And even though Stringer is like really making a good faith effort to legitimize this whole operation, he still has to really chew Shamrock out for doing something so stupid. And it's very comical.
Don't take notes on a criminal conspiracy. So, you know, from there, String and Bodhi have a meet. I think I jumped ahead a couple episodes ago after listening to the commentary, getting all excited about this and that, talking about the irony that David Simon pointed out of two of these guys meeting in front of the Museum of Industry. And this is actually the scene in the harbor. So just a whole lot, you know, being said there without really having to do any more like what I'm trying to do now, just conjecture.
I mean, Bodhi is kind of like flabbergasted, or he's like surprised and confused by the police's whole approach to letting them sell drugs in like an open market. And he's like coming to String in an effort of good faith, like to like ask him like what's going on. And Stringer automatically assumes that Bodhi's wearing a wire and telling him not to sell drugs. And it's like, it's pretty like terrifying in this instance. But it's like Bodhi is like still is pretty sharp by this point that he lifts up his shirt and like starts to take off his pants to like show him that he's not wearing a wire, because like he knows like if Stringer really did believe that Bodhi had flipped, like he would have him killed no problem. So
String's also attempting to have a parlay, if you will, up in Sandtown, Winchester, apparently on Riggs and Calhoun. That's where Kima wants to draw McNulty to, because obviously there's a pretty major meet occurring. Yeah, Marlo's picked a pretty secure location that String's, I don't know how pleased he is, because he says the only bugs will be the kind you squash or step on. He's into the finer things. So going from his posh penthouses or condos on the waterfront to this abandoned house in West Baltimore. So, you know, he manages, even if the end result's not what he wanted. So, but there's a lot going on in this conversation. So he just rattles off some pretty big names. It's interesting. I mean, of course, they're always weaving it all in. You could tell, you know, Simon and Burns really putting their touch on things, because he's like Melvin. And then he says Little Will, which I don't know. I don't know if that rings a bell, but to me, it's kind of like, you know, they say Melvin, but they don't, you know, say the whole thing. So maybe they're breaking up his full name, like Little Melvin Williams, Melvin Little Will. I don't know. That's what I think. And then Warren, who you're kind of talking about. Is this a time where have I mentioned that my like conspiracy theory, or am I going to get too off track here with the whole Warren Bordley thing? Because I think that's who he's referencing, the pretty big time dude, big time dealer who got in the whole war against the Downers, gets with the brothers Spencer and Alan, who I know were kind of, well, I'll take the fall on this one with the Truth Be Told book, which it's a phenomenal piece of work, but we talk about there's some errors here and there. And I was saying maybe we could submit an amendment, because apparently 7 people died in that summer of 86 in the war against the Downers. But I think in actuality, now it's 8, because Alan Downer, one of the brothers, got shot twice that summer on 2 separate occasions. And then in 2019, he died. And they said it was from, you know, all the injuries he sustained, where he had become paralyzed from the neck down. And I was like, what if the guy early on in maybe season 1, episode 5, who he visits to, you know, a little slow, a little late, what if that's Alan Downer? But wow. I don't know, how is that, would that even be legal? Or, you know, like who would sign a consent form? I guess his estate or the hospital. I don't know, but I doubt that's true. But anyways, so he mentions Warren Bordley. And then here's another one. The whole does he say Big Head brother, or does he say Big Head or Brotherly? So I know I'm who he's referencing, though, is a pretty interesting character in his own right. Was also a real drug dealer, big time, probably, you know, bigger than a dealer, not middleman, not someone Colvin would have sent Carver and Herc out to round up. So his name was Bernard Big Head Brother Lee. So pretty bizarre story. So I think in 69, about, little Melvin got his first major conviction. And when he went to jail, I'm like, it was a pretty big sentence, but it ended up becoming only like 2 years or so. But basically, Bernard Big Head Brother Lee was already, I think he was working with Melvin, or he was around and he was involved in the drug trade. Basically, little Melvin and his wife at the time, Katie, I think her name was, got a divorce or they separated. I'm not sure all the details. She started basically living with Bernard Big Head Brother Lee, like they were a couple, that when, as Melvin was, you know, in jail. And then he basically got hold of the huge connect with Frank Pee Wee Matthews, who, you know, we know is like one of the biggest suppliers ever. And he skipped out on his huge bond and disappeared in 1973. And then, yeah, like that was pretty much, I guess, the downfall of Bernard Lee, because now his connect was gone. And then little Melvin happened to get out because, you know, he's like a genius, and got his, GED, I think, during that time. So look at this episode, man, talking about GED. He like scored the best on the test. He was like a math whiz, gambling savant and all that. So they're like, he's a great candidate for rehabilitation. So he gets let out. And then, I think around that time too, Bernard Lee got, he got like indicted. You know, he's going in, Melvin's coming out, and he's like, okay, well, now my connect's gone. He disappeared, Frank Matthews. So I'm going to start this co-op. And he pretty much got a bunch of young dealers together. And like around, yeah, that summer, I think, of basically, yeah, they got together at a hotel up in West Baltimore in July of 73 on Reisterstown Road, which is, yeah, just like above West Baltimore, heading north.
Damn.
And this is around the time he's like, call me Black now, because he was like dressing all black. He didn't want to be little Melvin anymore. So we saw he got introduced as Black recently as one of his aliases. So I found it interesting too. Yeah, because when Bernard Big Head Brother Lee was in jail, and one of it, like, he got sentenced to 10 years. And then while he was in jail, he was still running a huge ring, a heroin ring with the Turks. So I know, I've always like, oh, were there actually Greeks involved in this? But he was working with the Turks, who the Greeks in this show hated. And then he got another 10 years while in jail, and all this other crazy stuff happened. Two brothers named with the last name Burrell kidnapped his daughters and held them for ransom. I don't know how that relates to anything. Burrell on the other side of the law, Willie? Huh? More conspiracies? No. But out of all this, where does it even get string though? Marlo doesn't seem to be interested. He skipped history class. He wouldn't care. I'll save that. Sorry. I'll save that spiel if we, you know, run into Jamie Hector at Harlow. He won't be interested. He'll just do more vacant stares through me, through my soul till I run away. Also, they brought a peanut in the spiel history class with string, which is, you know, maybe just like building on this whole peanut angle with Bunk. It's not that peanut. I think he meant like Maurice Peanut King, who was like a huge East Side dealer too, involved in Odell's Club and all that. But yeah, man, Marlo, he's ready for war. So, and as he's delivering that message to Chris, who's getting out from jail.
Avon gets out and he's at a party. And, you know, if there was any, if there was like any daylight that some of these more legitimate people like, well, I say legitimate in, you know, quotation marks, because Clay Davis and Levy and Krawcheck, like they're allegedly on the other side of the law. They're fully in bed with them at this point. And it's showing Avon a different side of what could potentially be of their whole operation in the long run if he cooperates with Stringer's vision. But we already see that he's not about to cave into a more, you know, pencil pushing lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, he's already got his eyes he's already zeroed in on Gerard and Sapper,
right? Yeah,
they're high again. Thankfully, I mean, Cuddy's not there. Maybe he would have, I don't know, that would have been interesting if he would have got involved in that. But Avon's already picking up on things that String, you know, has pretty much let get away. Obviously, had his eyes on what he deemed to be a bigger prize with the political, corrupt elements involved in the city's infrastructure. So Avon's already starting to mop up, and maybe it's already creating a source of tension. Yeah, I mean, more club music, more wild partying. Avon is trying to holler, but String is just being a nuisance. But then it all comes around and kind of throws a curveball at Avon. I just want to let you know when your first night at the club happens, and whenever that is, and you're trying to holler, and I keep on bugging you like, Willie, we should edit this part, we should do this, you know, we should include this this piece. Oh yeah, this I forgot this bit of geography. Well, let's talk. Let's come over here. Like, just know it could all be, you know, just part of my scheme. But if we're drunk like Bunk, it's probably actually all just nonsense that I'm feeding to you. All right, man. It's time. With that said, let's sign off. I'm going to go watch this Warriors games. So yeah, man, that's our show. Thanks so much, everyone. We appreciate, your support. If you ever want to check us out, we're up on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
That's right. If you ever have any questions, comments, concerns, email us at thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com.
Yeah, dude, I got the password now, and I'm checking it out once in a while. So you never know who. I mean, it's the gods will not save you, but you know, we're covering our bases. Anyways, special thanks, our guy Mostar, very generous always with his music, intro, outro, bumpers. Yeah. Check him out, Mostar.com. He's got some new stuff. I gotta listen. I gotta get with it, man. I gotta listen. But great guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Looking forward to seeing more live music performances he does in the future as the pandemic hopefully dwindles down. Also, shout out and thanks to Andre Tesnes, who did the incredible work on our podcast logo. Great guy.